Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today in WILL AM 580, December 20th, 2011. Today we're going to be talking about the financial crisis, its after effects, and what's coming up down the road from one of the leading activists who's been working on this issue for the past several years. We'll also be talking about the uprising in Wisconsin that's been taking place over the last week, where our guest has been central to covering it, participating in it, and she will be here hopefully to help us understand it. It's going to be a great hour today on WILL, but before we go to our guest, let's first go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
And I'm Megan Tatey.
As extremists in Congress take steps to kill funding for public broadcasting, a new report suggests our nation's public media need more money to serve the public, not less. The study analyzes public media in 14 democratic countries and contrasts them with America's system. The results? We're lagging far behind. Rodney Benson, professor at New York University and co-author of the study, set out to understand how other countries were able to create powerful public media.
How is it that you can have government-funded media and yet have media that's also independent, critical, diverse? And what is it that makes that work?
He found that the strongest public media systems in the world were the best funded and insulated from political meddling, and the United States trails in both measures.
Off the bat, one interesting finding is just how small public media is in this country compared to virtually every other leading democracy in the world. The gap there in funding is just astronomical.
Americans consistently rate public media as their most trusted news source, but public media are starved for federal funding in the U.S. Per capita, public funding of PBS and NPR is less than $1.50. Compare that to $30 to $130 invested by countries like Germany, Canada, and Sweden. Benson says the public in those countries receives great benefits from the investment.
The result is that the level of public knowledge about government and international affairs is high across the population. It's not just an elite kind of knowledge. And I think that strengthens democracy. So that's why it's so important to have strong public media. And it's more important than ever now in the United States when commercial media are backing away from their public interest obligations.
With his research pointing to a need for a new, better era for public media, Benson is troubled by the calls to gut its funding.
It's already underfunded, and so to talk about zeroing out the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, it's just going in the wrong direction.
To read the full report, visit savethenews.org.
Internet freedom was on full display in the revolutions in Tunisia and Egypt, sparking debate about communications infrastructure and how to balance liberty and security, transparency and confidentiality. This week in the United States, the federal government sent mixed messages about the importance of an open and non-discriminating net. On Tuesday, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton outlined a new Internet freedom policy to help people around the world break through the cyber walls built by repressive governments to silence dissent.
The United States will continue to promote an internet where people's rights are protected and that it is open to innovation, interoperable all over the world, secure enough to hold people's trust, and reliable enough to support their work.
On Wednesday, Republicans in the House sent a very different message. They introduced a measure that would block any regulation of any sort over the internet. Their resolution of disapproval would overturn the Federal Communication Commission's net neutrality ruling and prevent the FCC from creating or enforcing any other rules. The result would leave the internet vulnerable to abuse from the likes of Comcast, AT&T, and other service providers that can blackmail their customers with a choice of paying whatever the company demands or being cut off from the world. Congressman Joe Barton, the Texas Republican who apologized to BP for the administration's response to the company's oil spill last year, spoke to the FCC on Wednesday.
We're not so opposed, those of us that oppose this 3-2 ruling, because of what you ruled, but the fact that you established the principle, if it goes unchallenged, that you can regulate the internet. That's what troubles me.
Mike Doyle, a Democrat from Pennsylvania, disagreed.
That's like saying you can only create rules for mortgages when housing prices plummet, or that you can't ensure that new investors aren't being built until millions have lost their nest eggs. This is what open internet means to me. It means that, one, my family can use any service on the internet using any device we choose to use. Two, we give innovators the ability to create new things for us so that we can use our internet connections and new gadgets for us to use that we never dreamed possible. And then three, we provide a cop on the beat to make sure that all these promises of an open internet are kept for us.
Now that the resolution of disapproval has been introduced in the House and Senate, Congress has 60 days to vote on it. For more information, go to savetheinternet.com. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, February 20, 2011, here on WILL AM 580. We've got a great show for you today. It's been one we've been working on for a while, but hoping to have, and it's extraordinarily fortuitous. We planned the show originally. We wanted to have Mary Vitari, our guest, on because we were going to be talking about the financial crisis, financial reform, the foreclosure crisis, all the really extraordinary political and economic issues of our times. And we settled it for this week, and Mary Vitari is here in our mobile studio to talk with us. But then in the last week, as I know many of my listeners, but many of you are familiar with, the state of Wisconsin has exploded in a political uprising, there's no other word for it, by the public sector unions and their supporters who have basically taken over the capital of the state of Wisconsin in a way unprecedented, going back at least 40 years, if not longer, in American history to see an uprising of this kind. And Mary Vitari, our guest, has been in the middle of everything, down there working on it. And as we'll find out today, the two issues she works on, the issues she works on in terms of financial reform and fiscal irresponsibility and fraud in the financial sector, correlates closely to the crisis facing public sector finances and public sector workers and the attack on those unions. So I'm glad to welcome today to Media Matters, our guest, Mary Vitari, director of the Center for Media and Democracy's Real Economy Project, and the editor of the Bankster USA website, which is at banksterusa.org. Mary Vitari, welcome to Media Matters.
Thank you, Bob. Glad to be here.
Well, let's get right to work and just talk first about Wisconsin. Because I know I've got a lot of listeners saying, are you going to do something about it this week? And we'll link it up to some of the other work you've been doing on fraud closure, on the fiscal crisis, on the corruption of the financial system, which continues unabated, as you've reported, on your website and in your columns and in your articles. But first, Wisconsin. I know a lot of our listeners, or most are in Illinois, but we have podcast listeners and web listeners across the planet to the show and across the country. It's Sunday today. We're coming live. Just talk a little bit, if you will, about the events of the last, say, 9 days, what triggered this and what has been happening in the last 9 days. And you know, maybe you know, you have been so busy, I don't know if you had a chance to see much of the media coverage. You mentioned that to me. But maybe from what you sense, people might not fully understand by the way media normally cover these events.
Yeah, my understanding is it's being covered as sort of a budget crisis, as sort of a fiscal crisis, and workers are being asked to sacrifice. And so they're really mad about that, and they're circling the Capitol and creating a hullabaloo. Well, it has a lot to do with the fiscal crisis, the global fiscal crisis, and the fact that the banksters collapsed the economy and put our economy in a terrible hole. Now, oddly enough, the state of Wisconsin is not in such bad shape. We do have a small budget deficit. But what's happening...
Nowhere as bad as Illinois, by the way.
Nowhere as bad as California. Nowhere as bad as Illinois. It's... The numbers are that the governor was slated to come in with a surplus, oddly enough, of some $1.21 million. But because he gave away $100 million in tax breaks to corporations, he's claiming that we now have a crisis on our hands. And who's going to be the scapegoat of the crisis? Well, public workers.
Well, let me ask you about that, Mary Vitari, because I think when anyone has listened to the Republican lawmakers, including Governor Walker, on the national media, Fox News, MSNBC, CNN, the network news, they always talk about a $3 billion shortfall. I mean, they're not talking, you know, $50 million here, $100 million there. They make it sound... When Governor Walker talks, he says basic, he makes it sound like the shortfall is so enormous that it's basically we do this or everyone in this state will die. It's the most grave fiscal situation any society has ever faced.
Yes.
The great inflation of Weimar Germany looked like a fake by comparison. I mean, where do they come up with this $3 billion?
Well, they're over 2 years, after all these tax breaks are implemented, after all these other giveaways to his corporate CEOs, buddies and funders and those kinds of folks, we will have a two-year deficit. But the deficit is half, less than half of what it was a few years ago. I mean, a few years ago, we faced a $6 to $7 billion deficit, and we made a lot of hard choices, and a lot of people tightened their belts, and we cut a lot of programs, and that was the big one. And then he's being handed, literally this year, a surplus, and he decides to give away a lot of money and take it out of the hide of workers. But the second thing that happened is in this budget bill that he's talking about, he severely impairs collective bargaining rights of workers. It's, every worker in the state is covered by state law that gives them a right to collectively bargain, to organize, to form unions, to sit at the table and have a voice on wages and hours and working conditions and those kinds of things. And that is why the people are on the streets. That is what they want to protect, is very strongly this 50-year tradition we have in Wisconsin where people have a say at the negotiating table about their working conditions and wages.
Our guest today in Media Matters, you've just been listening to, is Mary Batari from Bankster USA and the Center for Media and Democracy, where she works on financial issues, financial reform, uncovering, exposing, and researching what's actually taking place in our banking and financial sector, and then how well regulation is developing or taking place or not taking place. She also is a resident of Madison, Wisconsin, where the Center for Media and Democracy is headquartered. So she has firsthand been a participant and observer in the uprising of public workers and their supporters across the state, but particularly taking over the state capital of Wisconsin for the last 7 days in what I think can safely be said are historically astonishing developments in American politics that are still leaving, I think, anyone who's been around this, Madison for the past week, speechless almost. I find myself, there aren't words yet quite describe what is the vibrations, the karma, pick your term, the intensity of what's going on with 60, 70,000 people from all walks of life surrounding the Capitol in what could be probably, from my experience, and I had the ability to participate for a few days and size up what was going on, what was a, it's difficult to express, unless someone participates in something that size and magnitude, what it's like when you have that many people together of goodwill who are supportive. And, it was, there's probably less antagonism among those 70,000 people in the last 7 days than there is in a single bar. We have more than three guys drinking beer, or 10 guys drinking beer in America at any bar in this country.
Yes, they probably disagree more over beer than for the reasons why they're standing there. I mean, I'm amazingly proud of this state this week because Wisconsin workers got it. They got it right away that this was not about Wisconsin, but that it was that we were targeted deliberately because we have this strong history, because we have these strong unions, and because the Republicans now control all three houses. And
the governor and the two.
The Assembly and the Senate. And if they can come for us in Wisconsin and get rid of our collective bargaining rights in Wisconsin, they can do it anywhere. So I am absolutely sure that, Karl Rove or some of these guys at the national level plotted this out during the campaign season. This is not what Governor Walker ran on. He's a fairly moderate Republican. We've known him for a lot of years. He campaigned on creating jobs and balancing the budget and in a campaign in a very mild-mannered way. For him to come out of the box in this kind of deliberative assault to threaten to call in the National Guard, do all these kinds of things is astonishing.
The number here at Media Matters, if you'd like to call in with a question or comment from Mary Batari, is 217-333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. And Mary Batari, you're up in Madison. You know the economics of the state well. As I understand it, just some of the facts here, the governor's bill that he's proposed, he has the votes to win that and since they have huge majorities in both the House and Senate, and this has become sort of the defining issue, according to Governor Walker, you get rid of these unions or lessen their rights dramatically. And the opponents, labor and the Democrats who oppose it, are really in a difficult spot. And the way they've prevented it so far is that the 14 of the 33 state senators who are Democrats have fled the state and gone to Illinois. So they're probably, who knows, maybe they'll get the Champaign-Urbana if they're lucky. But they have to stay outside of the state. As soon as they come back from the state, they can be corralled and forced to go back to the Senate, and then it's going to pass.
Well, you know, I'm a little bit more hopeful than that. You know, this type of mean-spirited politics is fairly new to Wisconsin. I mean, I was talking to some legislators, and they're at each other's throats up there, and they're very uncomfortable with it right now. And there are some Republicans who have a lot of doubts about this. There are reportedly 3 or 4 Republicans who have a lot of doubts about this. But just as they're getting pressure from the street, they're getting pressure, I'm sure, from top Republican leaders in the state and nationwide to stick to their guns. So I have a little bit of hope that some of these Republicans can be talked into common sense and vote right on this issue. But the Democrats did take that dramatic gesture of fleeing the state solely in order to prevent a vote and to give time for more public debate. And we have had continuous hearings in the Capitol every day and well into the night from people talking about this legislation.
And just one last word on the demonstrations, because you've been there, I think, every day around the clock. They've been, in my lifetime, nothing like it.
Mm-hmm.
Just describe, if you would, for listeners, to give a sense of what the last 7 days in the center of Madison, Wisconsin, have been like, and especially the Capitol building, this amazing building to begin with. And what's taking place inside of it?
Outside has just been stunning. You know,
it's the largest state capitol in the country. I mean, it's very close to the federal size. It's not even larger. It's an enormous building.
It's a four-wing state capitol. It has 36 types of marble in it. It has beautiful paintings on the ceiling. It has gilt and gold touchings here, there, and everywhere. It's a stunning building, and we're very proud of the building. And so on the outside, the marches have doubled their size almost every day until Sunday, until Saturday night, which is our largest crowd yet, projected to be around 80,000. And the atmosphere is just stunning. There's, you know, all sorts of fun signs, like if you can read this sign, thank a teacher. The teachers in Madison walked out. They've been they have not been in school for 3 days. So that allowed my daughter and a whole bunch of elementary school students an opportunity to come up to the Capitol and protest. So it's been fun. There's been lots of kids. Inside, the Capitol has been transformed. It's been taken over, and it's been transformed to a work center for the protesters. There's posters on the wall, low-tech Twitter, this is what happened today. So that's the way people are communicating inside. They also have information station where people can go and do testimony and hearings. They can get housing. They can get an apple and some peanut butter. And it's very well organized and extremely vibrant.
Our guest, Mary Vitari. This is Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We're coming to you live today. We're talking about Bankster USA. We're talking about the Center for Media and Democracy. Mary Vitari, expert on financial reform and expert on the financial crisis, and has been covering it as a journalist and as an activist for the last 2 years, writing about it widely. Go to banksterusa.org to find the website with all the work on it, or go to prwatch.org, which is the parent website for the group, for the Center for Media and Democracy. If you'd like to call in with question or comment, the number again at Media Matters is 217-333-9455, or our toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. And Mary, let's back up now and connect the dots here. How does the attack on public sector workers link into the financial crisis? What's the connection here?
Well, you know, as you know, Bob, we called our website Bankster USA because we wanted to focus in real hard on the culprits. So we do a lot of writing about the too big to fail institutions, J.P. Morgan Chase, Citigroup, Goldman Sachs, all these guys. We do a lot of writing about the lack of criminal prosecutions. I mean, they've been fined up the wazoo by the SEC and the CFTC, but the Department of Justice can't get its act together, and neither can state attorney generals to actually convict any of these guys of any wrongdoing, even though there's been case after case after case and fine after fine after fine for fraud, for accounting fraud, for insider trading.
To be honest, I mean, if you're not sending some of these guys to prison, or gals, those are women too, some of these people prison, for these what are documented crimes. And there's no other word for it. It's not like, oh, I pushed the wrong button accidentally sort of stuff.
Right.
Where you actually take toxic stuff and you sell it as the real deal. And you're making hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars from doing this stuff. If you don't go to jail, if you get a slap in the wrist, you know, why would we ever expect that won't come right back?
To happen again. Yeah. It's sort of unbelievable.
$1 billion and you just have to pay a $50,000 fine, you know, I'll take that. I like those odds.
Well, Goldman Sachs paid $500 million. Now it's just the cost of doing business. I bet you they have a little account for this expenditure right now.
Take like 0.1% of their bonus budget.
Yeah, really. So you know, there's a lot of rage in America right now. There's still a lot of anger at the banks. It pulls off the charts still. People are pissed about the banks. They're pissed about the bailouts. And what is what's the response from the conservative wing of America? Well, the response is to turn the tables and take this rage against the banks and everything that just happened and use it against unions, public sector workers, and to gin up gin them up as the villains and gin up the deficit and government spending as the causes of the crisis. And if Americans are buying into this, it's completely mind-boggling to me.
I certainly don't seem to be buying into it. When it's presented coldly, you know, maybe in some sort of abstract method, you pull on very abstract terms. Yeah, I don't like deficits.
Right.
But if you pull on, like, okay, here's the information why we have the deficit, what should we do about it? People don't even say, gee, I see that the bankers sold a bunch of toxic assets to the state and destroyed the pension funds. Therefore, I think the people who've worked honestly for a living should pay a price, and people who made a fortune off it should go scot-free. I don't think that polls well.
No, that's right. And there's a lot of common sense out there. I mean, people understand that no Wisconsin snowplow driver gambled on Wall Street and collapsed the economy, that no Wisconsin teacher, you know, shipped jobs to China. And hopefully folks will come out and support these workers who are, you know, fighting for their lives and their right to form unions. That's what they're fighting for.
Well, let's talk about some of this, the pension plans in particular. One of the big arguments that we hear in state governments everywhere, and I don't know how much truth there is to it. I mean, this is it's an important empirical question, is that the public workers with unions have been able to get pension plans that are the envy of the world, that they are simply unbelievably good, and that since private sector workers' jobs have gotten so crappy in the last 40 years and lost a lot of their privileges, that now it's not fair that public sector workers get to keep their privileges. I mean, sort of like everyone should have crappy jobs.
No people
should be allowed to have a good job. It's sort of like reverse solidarity. If there's one person with a crappy job, everyone has to have a crappy job. Everyone have a good job. How much are the pensions of these public workers, especially unionized public workers, as the better ones, unions, how much is that to blame for the crisis?
Well, my understanding, and these are like national numbers, that the pension payouts themselves are not that enormous. And I saw a number, that was something like the average payout was $25,000. I don't actually know what it is per year. I don't actually know what it is in the state of Wisconsin, but here's what's been happening in Wisconsin. We have a good pension plan, and it's well managed. It's not in crisis like it is in many, many states. And the workers in Wisconsin are underpaid on average by 10%, and the trade-off has always been that you get better benefits. And when you get better benefits, people want to stay. They want to invest in the economy. They want to raise their children here. You get a more stable workforce. You get more expertise and these kinds of things. So, you know, the question for the American people is, do you want to race to the bottom or do you want to race to the top? Everyone deserves a good pension. And after the financial crisis and so many 401ks were wiped out, you would think that the 401k experiment would be over, but it's not. It's everyone's sort of like still trying to save money through a 401k. I mean, what we need is a national strategy on pensions where people can have their Social Security and add to it and have a national pension plan the way that many countries do around the world.
Well, it's funny, Mary Batari, that's the best use of English language. What was interesting, better word, is that in 2008, in the fall of 2008, when the entire economy teetered on complete disintegration and meltdown into deep depression, and we were very much teetering on the edge of that abyss, and it was understood across the board, the reason for this was deregulation of the financial sector had allowed institutions to take extraordinarily absurd risks that jeopardized the entire economy. They built this huge financial superstructure vastly greater than the productive base of the economy, and it couldn't hold it up at a certain point in time with all the toxic debt. And the logical solution then is you re-regulate the financial sector like it had been during the most successful periods of American capitalism by far. And from 1945 to 1982, it was super regulated. We barely had any bank failures at all, much higher rate of growth. And you keep that financial sector under lock and key. I mean, you don't let these guys go run wild. And that was almost a general, everyone sort of immediately a reaction to the financial crisis of late 2008 and the coming deep recession was, that's where you start.
Right.
You go there like Roosevelt did in 1933 in what the Congress did in the 30s. They understood you've got to get that financial sector back under control, and you got to get money being given for real investments, not for poker games by billionaires.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened to all that energy? What was the result of that? What do you make of how the politicians addressed the crisis in the last 2 years?
Well, so I worked along with about 250 other groups and organizations in a big coalition on the Dodd-Frank reform bill.
You know, what was the Dodd-Frank reform bill?
So that is the Wall Street reform bill that passed in July of 2010. And it's best known because it creates a Consumer Financial Protection Agency, and now Elizabeth Warren has been hired to set it up, although she's not been hired as a director. And that will provide, at sort of the more micro level, that will provide consumers with some real protections in the future on credit card, predatory lending, payday loans, and those kinds of issues. What I worked on were the bigger picture issues of giant, too-big-to-fail institutions. How do we rein them in? Derivatives and reckless Wall Street gambling. How do we bring transparency to that market? How do we bring more stability to that market? And, you know, we lost on the too-big-to-fail issue. That was the big failure in the bill, I think. And
we have more tighter concentration of ownership now in the banking sector than ever before in American history right now.
Yes.
Worse than 2007.
Right. In the 1990s, the six largest financial institutions represented something like 17% of U.S. GDP. Now their assets are 64% of GDP. So talk about too big to fail. One of these behemoth institutions falling down, like Bank of America.
14-year period, so from 17% to 64% of assets.
It is quite stunning, yes.
Yeah, well, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but that's a sort of
that was what we were trying to tackle. That was the issue that we were trying to tackle, and there was an amendment in the debate that would have limited the size of these institutions to 2% of GDP, and it would put in hard capital requirements and leveraging limits and those kinds of things, and that failed. There was another amendment that would have separated the casino from the bank, and that was something offered by Senator Blanche Lincoln of Arkansas, who all of a sudden got the spirit once she got into a tight election race against the more progressive candidate. Now, in the primary, she was in a tight race, and she all of a sudden got the spirit. Anyways, her bill would have required the big banks to spin off their swaps desk, their derivatives desk, where they do all this gambling, into a separate company that was separately capitalized and not backed by the taxpayers at all. That was a brilliant idea. It was a sort of modern Glass-Steagall.
Excellent. And so when Dick Durbin was on the floor of the Senate from Illinois, and he was talking about the first wave of discussion on financial reform, Mary Vitari, he made a point of just acknowledging, let's face it, the banks own Congress,
yeah.
Both parties, both houses. In this crisis, we can't do anything. These guys basically have the deed to every member, pretty much, or most every member here. They've got a majority.
Right.
They completely control it. I mean, was Durbin accurate, do you think, basically?
Durbin was accurate, but what was different about this Wall Street reform bill, even though it was flawed, it didn't deal with too big to fail, even though it was flawed, is that it got better as it went along. So we tried to pass this provision with forcing the banks to spin off the casino. We didn't get it, but we got extremely strong derivatives regulations.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to have position limits. Every derivative trade is going to be out in the sunshine. We're going to have margin requirements. We're going to have capital. We'll bring more stability to the system.
Will this be enforced, though?
Well, now it's all in jeopardy. I'm so glad you asked, because
no bill is no law is good enough.
Well, now we're involved in 280 rulemakings related to the bill. Regulations are as good as the regulators, and we've got some good regulators right now. Sheila Bair at FDIC is excellent. Gary Gensler at the Commodities Future Trading Commission is excellent. But we're very worried about the future and where these things will go.
Our guest, Mary Vitari from BankToUSA.org, from the Center for Media and Democracy, is one of the leading journalists, activists, researchers working on the financial crisis and financial reform. If you'd like to call in and join us at WILL AM 580, the number here is 217-333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. We're also talking about the uprising of public workers and citizens in the state of Wisconsin over the last 7 days that Mary Vitari, being based in Madison, has participated in personally, been active in, been covering it and blogging about it at the Center for Media and Democracy's website. Let's go to the phone lines right now with our first callers and waiting patiently. Line 1, Champaign County, you're on the air.
Hi. I watched some of the chat shows this morning, and it was very predictable the way they covered Wisconsin. But they did say something about the governor, when he was county executive in Milwaukee, did something very similar, slashed earth versus the union. So even though I've heard from John Nichols on Democracy Now! That he didn't really campaign on this, but if you looked at what he had done, that it shouldn't have been that much of a surprise, and the Democratic candidate should have been drumming that more, I guess. But I wanted to make a further point about, and there have been guests about educational policy, but it seems to me that the words we heard from Obama about this were quite good, but they rang kind of hollow, sort of like the same way he was applauding the uprising in Egypt, because he didn't really fess up to what the U.S. has been doing through this time, and vis-a-vis the uprising in Wisconsin, the teachers' unions have been the butt of a lot of attacks from Arnie Duncan and the educational department, and it's sort of, I see it as setting the stage for this kind of a scenario, and it really needs to be said, I think, so...
Thank you very much, caller. Mary Vitari, I mean, do you have any comments?
Well, what Obama had to say, it seems to me, we went right down the middle. He said, well, we all have to tighten our belts. And then he also said, but it seems a little bit like it's a frontal attack on the unions. So he went right down the middle. And that language isn't helpful right now.
I must say, this isn't original to me. I think this has been covered on Bill Maher's show, and Rachel Maddow has covered this a great deal. Chris Hayes has also covered it on MSNBC. It's hard not to avoid the conclusion when you look at the evidence that if you look at the top funders now of political candidates of either party for the 2010 election, 7 of the 10 are corporate groups and corporate front groups like Karl Rove. 3 of the 10 are unions. 2 of those 3 unions are public sector unions, AFSCME and Teachers Union, National Education Association. And if you get rid of 2 of the 3 public sector unions who primarily fund Democrats, you're left basically with all the organized money in town going to Republicans. It's going to be really hard, much harder, the degree of difficulty for Democrats to win elections in that context. It's going to go way up. So Obama's in the middle of the road on this. I mean, as Jim Hightower said, there's nothing in the middle of the road but dead armadillos. I mean, am I missing something? Shouldn't there be like sort of, hey, our party might not survive if we don't have organized labor anymore? That, business is not giving us any money, no matter how pro-business we act.
I talked to a teacher. I said, what is this about? Why are people here? And she went to her straight to the heart of the matter, and she said, this is about 2012. This is about destroying those phone polls that unions do, those foot soldiers that unions have, those little leaflets that decorate your door. This is what it's about. If they take away our collective bargaining rights, they destroy our ability to play in 2012. And she thinks it's a national strategy by the Republican leadership.
And I think what the caller's first point was is that Walker has shown hostility to public sector workers throughout his career. This isn't suddenly discovered after he got elected. Although I don't think he ever advertised he was going to try to get rid of them. Because, this is really a bold step. I mean,
it's a 50-year tradition in Wisconsin,
so
a 50-year law.
American states have these rights for public work. It's not like Wisconsin is this sort of freak-out state. Mm-hmm. There's only 5 or 6 states in the country where public workers aren't allowed to organize at all. There's only another 5 or 6 or 7 where they have moderate rights. the vast majority of American states have the exact same rights they have in Wisconsin and Illinois, just full rights to organize like private sector workers.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is a dramatic shift. This is not just some minor marginal operation. Our guest, Mary Batari, this is Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, and WILL AM 580. Let's go back to the phone lines now to line 4, Bloomington. You're on the air.
Yeah, Bob, thanks once again for a great program. Can you hear me?
We can indeed.
Okay. Two things. If my understanding is correct, our teachers' fund was in fine shape and self-supporting and self, and until the governor borrowed from it and other things started happening. It sounds similar to Wisconsin. It's not the teachers' funds or pensions. And the other point is what was so shocking to me is this governor saying he would call out the National Guard. I'm not really clear on that, but if there was a protest. So if you could comment on that, I'd appreciate it. I may not have the facts quite correct. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much for your call, Mary Batari.
Well, when he held this press conference where he was talking about the bill, and he threw in the word National Guard quite a few times. Now, since then, he's tried to backpedal and said, I only meant that if the unionized prison officers went on strike, I only meant that we might use the National Guard in the prisons. But, you know, he had a very belligerent press conference where he threw around that word, and I think that was a big mistake. I saw hysterical signs. My favorite was from a nurse who had a sign that said, do you trust the National Guard to give your daughter chemotherapy? And another nurse who said, do you trust the National Guard to input a Foley catheter? And I don't know what a Foley catheter is, but I think that helped turn out the crowd because they were very pissed at being disrespected in that way.
Also, I think that puts the lie to the notion that this is something he campaigned on and that he advertised he was going to do, and no one should be surprised. If this is something everyone's well aware is coming down the pike, you don't announce it with several references that people don't like it, the National Guard are going to come kick some butt. Because, you know, that's sort of like, I know this is going to shock people and they aren't going to like it. They weren't expecting this one, so get ready. Our guest, Mary Batari, the phone lines here at WILL at Media Matters are open at 217-333-9455, toll free 1-800-222-9455. Let's go back to the phone lines now. Line 1, Champagne, you're on the air with Mary Batari.
Yes, thanks. I've been trying to listen about this whole affair, and I have two questions. One is, I understand that the Tea Party had a counter demonstration. Could you kind of sketch what happened there? And number two is, and I'll hang up after this and listen to over the air. I understood that the fire and police were kind of on the governor's side in this whole thing. And I was just wondering if that's true and what you think the consequences of that might be. And I'll hang up. Thank you.
Well, those are fantastic questions. And Mary Batari, we were talking about the Tea Party rally before going on air. Let's go to that second. First of all, though, I mean, I think this the caller's question about the firemen's unions and the police unions, state troopers unions, three unions were exempted from the union busting components. And those were the three unions, only three public workers unions that supported Walker's race for governor, which makes it, I mean, it's hard for anyone to look at that and say, this is a pure opportunism, isn't it? I mean, this is like blatant corruption.
It's also hard to make the argument, then, that collective bargaining isn't important. Because if it's important for the firemen and the other critical workers, why isn't it important for the prison guards and the snowplow drivers, you know? So I'm glad you asked about the firemen, because they have been the true heroes of these protests up here, and they've been coming through in phalanxes every single rally with their bagpipers, and they're completely standing in solidarity because they know this is the tip of the iceberg. They know that they're next. The police officers have been there too because they know that they're next.
Well, they're next unless they promise undying support in all terms to the Republican. They ever come out for Democrats, they're cooked. I guess that's the moral of the story.
Right. And so every time they walk through the crowd, they get big cheers and many thanks from everyone in the crowd.
on the Tea Party, there was, it took them a whole week to pull it together, but the Tea Party did pull together a rally on Saturday at 12 noon. And I got three crowd estimates from folks, and the ranges were between 2,000 and 4,000 for that rally. And then outside, circling the Capitol as the little Tea Party rally is going on the steps of the Capitol, was, you know, 50,000 teachers. And everybody here is wearing their Bucky Red, and they all have their children, and it's very inspiring. I was shocked, though, that the Tea Party brought in some of their ugliest members, I have to say. They brought in Andrew Breitbart, who did the takedown on the USDA employee, Shirley Sherrod.
Something I might add that for any credible journalist who ended your career,
right.
This guy's become a superstar, which I think speaks volumes about the ethics.
Yes, lie about public employees, and you advance in the Republican Party. He also took down Acorn. Tim Phillips, president of the Koch-founded Americans for Prosperity Group, was here. Jim Holt, who runs, I hadn't really heard of this guy until this week. He runs a blog called Gateway Pundit, and he was the interesting fellow that accused CBS reporter Laura Logan, who was very unfortunately sexually assaulted in Egypt this week, of bringing it on herself because she was there and she was blonde. So it was a very ugly group that showed up, and sort of un-Wisconsin,
their outreach crowd. We're trying to appeal to Wisconsin. I hate to see who their goon squad is. Our guest, Mary Batari from BanksterUSA.org and the Center for Media and Democracy. We're talking about the financial crisis, and we're also talking about what's been happening in Wisconsin for the last week. Mary Batari lives in Madison, where the Center for Media and Democracy is based and has been participating in and covering the uprising in Wisconsin last week. If you'd like to call in, again, the number 217-333-9455. Toll free, the number 1-800-222-9455. We have time for a couple more callers if folks want to call in. I want to go now back to financial stuff because, again, you point out they're very closely related. One of the big crises that's taking place in America that's getting some coverage, but, you know, 1/1,000th of the coverage it probably deserves in terms of the importance for the people living in this country listening to this program, is the foreclosure crisis. What is that? Why does it take place? What accounts for it? What's being done?
Well, this year we might see, and hopefully we will peak at 9 million foreclosure filings. Now, in most civilized societies, you know, the forcible migration of 9 million people, you know, cities the size of New York, is an economic and humanitarian catastrophe. I mean, you know, they fly in the helicopters and Angelina Jolie shows up, you know. But not in America, apparently. We have made no progress on this issue. These people have no options. And the same machine that sent these that allowed these ninja loans, the no document loans, and created this huge housing bubble, and they pushed those loans up to Wall Street that created the toxic mortgage and toxic securities. That same machine is now working to foreclose on people, the same institutions and the same machine, and nobody's getting in the way to stop it. But it's the root, the foreclosure fraud issue is the root of the next crisis, because there has been so much fraud. There's been false notarizations, false affidavits, false practice of law. I mean, there's been so many revelations coming out of these lawsuits about fraud in this area that it implies that the toxic securities or the securities that have been made out of these loans may be legally flawed themselves. And we have $14 trillion worth of mortgage-backed securities in our financial system. If these securities are ruled legally flawed, or some substantial portion of these securities are ruled legally flawed, that is the seeds of the next crisis. So Jamie Dimon at J.P. Morgan Chase has kindly promised us a financial crisis every 5 to 7 years, and it looks like there might be one on the horizon with this issue.
I mean, when you talk about a crisis, are we talking about possibly another 2008 of that magnitude, something that could really jeopardize the whole structure?
Well, it's unclear, because you have to get in there and see how much fraud exists. And I'm not sure that this is statistically or easily done, although anyways, they were able to do it in Florida. They were able to run some numbers in Florida and figure out what percentage of these mortgage pools were flawed. So anyways, well, they found a lot. And also the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission came out, and they found a lot, too. At one point in 2007, one of these firms, no, 2000 and, early in the crisis, I mean in 2006 perhaps, one due diligence firm was looking at these mortgages and finding just huge percentage of problems. Almost 50% of them were problematic mortgages. So anyways, it's just something to keep an eye on. This issue of fraud closure is an important one, something to keep an eye on, and we're waiting for the 50 state attorney general's investigation to come out about what their results are.
Let's go back to the phone lines now. We've got a couple of callers who've been waiting patiently. Our guest, Mary Batari from BanksUSA.org and the Center for Media and Democracy. I'm Bob McChesney. This is Media Matters and WILL AM 580. Let's now go to line one, Peoria. You're on the air.
Hello. Hello, Bob and Mary. Can you hear me?
We hear you great.
Yes. I'd like to make a comment and then ask a question. And, you know, while the financial crisis is certainly not was not brought on by labor unions, public labor unions, I think, you know, I run into it all over the place in the United States where people are frustrated with the value for money they're getting and the quality of the services they're getting from people who work in the public sector. And so, well, we have a crisis. Isn't it time to start addressing whether the people who are working in the public sector, maybe their pay or their compensation needs to be readjusted to be more commensurate with the value that they're offering?
Okay. Mary Batari?
Well, I have a different perspective because here in the state of Wisconsin, I have snowplow drivers who get me out in the morning, and I've just had a really excellent experience with my daughter's teachers and workers across the spectrum. I just don't know how you would implement that, So the workers in X state aren't good on the phone, so they should make less money. I mean, you know, if you're dissatisfied with public employees, you can complain to their boss and take other actions. But the question for us is, are we in a race to the top or are we in a race to the bottom? Do we want to have pensions in our system? Do we want to have good pay? Do we want to have a little bit of job security? Do we want to have a stable workforce where people can stay in their communities for a number of years and not be wandering migrants going from town to town looking for jobs? And those are rights and privileges that all of us should have, and we should be working together to provide them to more people, to provide good health care to more people, and provide better pension plans to more people.
I mean, Mary, the public sector is roughly 36% of the workers are protected by unions. In the private sector, I think it's down to 6 or 7%. And it was roughly 35% in the private sector 4 years ago, 50 years ago. So the public sector is back where the private sector used to be, and the private sector jobs are largely disappearing. And one of the major reasons for that is that the public sector governments are not allowed to break unions very easily. That's the problem they face. That's what Scott Walker says in Wisconsin. Private sector, it's a lot easier to get rid of unions and to break them, and the laws are written in such a way that they can exploit it. And so it suggests to me that if the private sector had to play by the same rules as the public sector, a lot of workers would love to have unions if they could, but it's impossible to organize for them in the private sector.
Yeah, you know, some of the signs from this weekend's rally really make the point. They said, together we can negotiate, and separately we have to beg. And no workers in any state should be in, you know, in a position where they just have to beg and beg and beg for every dime that it gets increased.
Okay, let's now go to our next caller who's waiting patiently. Champagne, line two, you're on the air with Mary Batari. Champagne, are you there? I think we're missing Champagne. They're not quite there with us yet. Well, you know, while we're trying to get that organized, let me ask you one more question about Elizabeth Warren, if I could. Her name has been in the news. She's become almost a folk hero among a lot of Americans for her directness and her plain speaking, concern with the criminality and the injustice of the financial crisis. Now, talk a little bit about her. I know you've worked with her a little bit. What is her role now? What has she done? And is she playing an important enough role in your view in what's going on in Washington?
Well, Professor Warren's been a hero of mine for many, many years because she has an excellent way of just taking issues like bankruptcy law and explaining it in a way that people know that matters. And that makes her a very dangerous person. The big banks do not want her in charge of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. They do not want her to get that job. Now, she sort of has it now because the president made a special appointment. But the president doesn't think he can get her through Congress and make a permanent appointment. We'd like to see that kind of permanent appointment. We'd like to see her long-term involvement with this agency. And the agency, people should know that the agency will open its doors in July of this year and that they already have a website up. They're trying to communicate with the public. So they're not taking a ton of complaints because they don't have the staffing yet, but they're trying to communicate with the public and saying, what do you think our top priorities should be? Should it be payday loans? Should it be student loans? Should it be fraud in the mortgage industry? Should it be whatever? And so that conversation is starting. We would like to see her appointed to that job. We'd like to see her passed in both houses. We'd like to have the fight and see where it goes. Because she is such a compelling personality. Yeah. And we got millions and millions and millions of emails and calls in support of the Consumer Financial Protection Agency, and those people could be put to work trying to get her to head it up.
You know, I think we've talked about this financial reform issue and the difficulty in getting really strong legislation through despite the gravity of the situation. And, I mean, are you surprised the Obama administration and the Democrats didn't step up more strongly, or do you think they really had their hands tied?
The blueprint, the sort of the blueprint for this out of the gate was handed to us by Hank Paulson and Tim Geithner. Okay, so they already set the bar extremely low. There was no major structural reforms. They just decided that they were going to tweak and manage the too big to fail institutions. Well, they managed them so well, they bailed them out to the tune of $4.4 trillion, that they're now larger than they ever were. Unfortunately, I'm a big booster of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. It's certainly a needed protection. But unfortunately, in the big picture, issues have not been addressed and still threaten the stability of our system.
And it seems like unless there's major reform, this is not going away. I mean, it's not like there's any incentive for these six banks that now have 67% of the assets of the country, the value in their of their control compared to 16% 13 years ago. You know, they're out to make money. That's their job. That's what they're, you know, and they have tremendous monopoly power now, and they have no fear of the politicians or regulators or very little. They're going to just do what they do. I mean, that's just, isn't that, I mean, it seems that unless there's, the market will not figure this one out for us, I guess, unless we want a depression.
No, that's true. And they, you know, they spend lavishly in the campaign cycle. They spend lavishly on lobbying. They spend lavishly on media trying to burnish their, you know, their image. There's ads up all the time about how Wells Fargo is in your side, even though it's foreclosing left, right, and center and not modifying people's loans. So it's a big task ahead, and we have to just be prepared for the next opportunity, and it will come to continue the fight to separate the bank and the taxpayer guarantee from the Wall Street casino and to rein in the casino more. And so what I'm working on in this year and into next year is a bill that would have a financial transaction tax on these speculators on Wall Street. It's a very small amount of money that you put on each transaction, whether it's a derivative or futures or stock or an option, and it slows down the casino wildly because you can't make these high volume, high speed trades if you're paying on every single trade.
It doesn't stop real investment. This has nothing to do with like whether this is building a factory on the outskirts of town or.
In fact, it helps real investment because the less money that they spend on the speculation, the more money that's available to lend for productive use. So I think this is called a financial transaction tax or financial speculation tax, and I think that's the way we need to go. It would raise $100 billion for job creation and other important social services at the same time.
But it seems, and we're beating the same note over and over, but why not? I mean, that seems so rational. That seems so impossible to criticize. It's just so logical.
Every major country in the world supports it right now, except us.
Yeah, and there's a very small lobby that directly benefits by this.
Right.
But it's also a lobby made up of some of the wealthiest individuals on the planet.
That's right. And so, for instance, J.P. Morgan Chase not only has its entire phalanx of lobbyists, it now has Bill Daley as the White House Chief of Staff. I mean, this is going to be a very heavy lift. But when they come for Social Security, when they tell you the deficit's going to ruin the world, when they come for Medicare and Medicaid, one of the questions we should be asking back is, well, have you thought about taxing the banks? Have you thought about taking it out of their hide, not ours? And so, you know, the Deficit Commission is encouraging us to raise taxes, gas taxes, and all sorts of taxes on consumers. And we should just be saying, well, have you really thought a little bit about, you know, a little tiny sales tax on Wall Street?
Marie Bitaro, we've only got a few minutes left. Can you talk a little bit about the Bankster USA project, the webpage, what you're doing, what people who are concerned about this issue and want to participate, how they can get involved?
So we at Bankster USA, we're involved in defense and we're involved in offense. And the defense is protecting the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau from Republicans who will be coming after it, making sure the derivatives chapter is implemented to bring stability to the system, to lower gasoline prices and lower commodity prices like agriculture that are being jacked up by speculators. So we're working hard on those kinds of issues. You can take action on our website on those types of issues. But we're also looking offensively at the battle ahead. So we're going to be working a lot on financial transaction tax and those kinds of things. I also want to mention that this week at prwatch.org, we are live blogging. We have five people live blogging on the rallies and what's going on in here in Wisconsin, both on inside the Capitol and outside the Capitol. We have pictures and video and all sorts of fun things. If you are there, you can send that information to us. And if you're not there, you can follow the daily details by watching it on our blog.
Is there any way that the protesters can win in Madison, do you think? Is there an end game there? Because it seems the Republicans have the votes, right, that we reached out.
The Republicans may have the votes. And so really the end game is the Senate. If we can convince a few Republican senators that this has gone too far. I mean, senators are saying they've never seen anything like this. If we can convince a few folks to have some common sense, we might be able to win it.
Mary Bitaro, we've only got about a minute left now. So is there something, an issue we haven't touched on with regard to the financial crisis that you'd like to alert our listeners to?
Well, I just want to say one more word about Wisconsin. I mean, the Tea Party event with these sort of odd national leaders that were pulled out sort of underscores that this isn't really a fight about Wisconsin. It's a national fight, that we're the first state that the teachers' unions and the public employees are the first whack at the tree that they're coming for. But we've seen this over and over and over again for 30 years. They gin up a crisis, and then they go after the people they wanted to go after all along. And that's happening here in Wisconsin, and it might spread to Ohio and Indiana and all these other states. And so it's a national emergency out here, and people should be tuning in and being active in their own communities.
Well, certainly people in Illinois are well aware of these issues. This has not been a minor factor down in the great state of Illinois. Mary Bitaro, I want to thank you so much for joining us today on Media Matters. It's been great having you here.
Thanks for having me.
And keep doing your great work. We'll be sure to get you back and stay in touch with you. I'm Bob McChesney, and I want to give a special shout-out and thanks to Norm Stockwell, who came, a friend of mine, is a technical expert, who came to help me work on my home studio here where I've been working out of, and we're still not quite done, but he's taken valuable time out of his weekends to help me out. And I want to thank Kyle Croha, my engineer, and Melissa Trentz, our fantastic producer. I'm Bob McChesney. Next week I'll be down in Campbell Hall. We've got a show on the future and fate of public media in America. It should be a wonderful show. Hope you all join us. Until then, everyone, have a great week.
Hi. Today, rain and some strong winds with a high near 56. Tonight, chance of rain with a low around 44. Monday, chance of rain with temperatures falling around 39. Monday night, chance of snow before midnight with a low around 22. Tuesday, partly sunny with a high near 34. And Tuesday night, partly cloudy with a low around 25. This is WILL 5.